So, this weekend is an attempt to establish the methods and directions for living as an unconditioned formless awareness, living as the unconditioned formless awareness. And it's while living as it, while fully functioning in the world of form. So, we're not separating nirvana from samsara, we're bringing them both together. And without separation or distinction, it's a paradox. How can you have nothing and something and live side by side with that? Well, you can, and it's a paradox. So you can't argue it mentally because you'll take one side or the other. That's what a paradox is. But as a living experience, they come together seamlessly. Remembering that this Heart Sutra is the single most recited, copied, and studied scripture in East Asian Buddhism. I mean, daily, they recite it, beautifully done. And I've done some Zen in my trainings, and I love it. They come in and they chant sometimes very systematically and rigorously, but it's so beautiful when you really allow yourself to enter the words of it. And then the Four Foundations is arguably the most important sutta in a sutra in the Theravadin tradition or sutta. I can't just. So all the difference of different branches of Buddhism can cooperatively work together if unless we become over ideological. And that's the hesitation I have. Because both of these suttas and sutras have been invested with so many years of of ideology, of what it means to me and what my teacher told me it meant, that we're not open anymore to seeing its fulfillment and its living fulfillment. And may I say, and I use that word living very deliberately, because you say, well, the Heart Sutra was 400 years ago, and the Four Foundations was 2,600 years ago. And so, what is it? I mean, they're separated by 2,000 years. Why are you trying to bring them together? Now, listen. This is where formless reality takes us. It doesn't take us into division of time. Everything that is arising now. And you can sense it, that together, this 400-year-old sutra and this 2,600-year-old sutta are coming together and they say something to each other. And they're completely compatible if we don't get stuck in the ideology. So we don't separate the Heart Sutra from the Four Foundations by hundreds of years. This weekend releases the need to be contentious and ideological, hopefully. So both Sutta and Sutra are arising together simultaneously in this moment. Simultaneously in this moment. Now the question we have is, do they come together? And the question that I hope to show you is that they do seamlessly in a singularity. They're as if they're written for each other, which if you don't separate them by the years of when they're actually written, then likely they are that singularity now and are expressing their reach across those years. And so I'm going to read the sutta and the sutra, and I'm not going to I'll talk a little bit about it as I read it, but mostly I just want you to hear it, and I'm not going to chant it. I don't have that voice, but here it goes. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Now, let me just frame that. Avalokiteshvara is the the incarnation of compassion. It's the bodhisattva of compassion, also known in, as Chenrezig, I think, in the Tibetan tradition, and Kuan Yin in the Chinese tradition. But basically, it's the heart. It's the compassionate heart. It's that is in while practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita. Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. So this depth of insight came to Avalokiteshvara while practicing the Prajna by the deepest wisdom, the deepest wisdom. You don't practice the deepest wisdom. You're still to what is. And that level of stillness takes you to the deepest wisdom. And so he says, from this deepest wisdom, he perceived that all five skandhas are empty. Skandhas are the five aggregates, for those of us who are on the Theravadin end of this. Form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And he says to Sariputra, now in the Theravadin tradition, Sariputra is the kind of the personification of wisdom. He's the disciple of the Buddha that had that is not acknowledged as the wisest. And he says, Sariputra, and it's a one-way dialogue. It's Sariputra never says anything in this, and he's just listening, which is incredibly respectful of the wisdom. Only somebody as wise as Sariputra would receive this without any, with complete openness and without any hesitation, without any, well, what about, you know, so, and supposedly this is Avalokiteshvara's initiation to Sariputra about what he has just seen. Sariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Now just think what he's saying in terms of our present form invasive world. He's saying what you see in front of your eyes isn't what you think you see. It, I should say, is what you think you see, but isn't its true substance, isn't its true formation, isn't its true value. That which is form is empty. That which is empty, form. The same is true for all the other skandhas, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. And I want to just stop for a second with consciousness, because most of us think, well, consciousness is always there. And in fact, science is now trying to reconcile where consciousness comes from, and they can't find it in the brain, and they can't place it anywhere, but it's so obvious that it's everywhere that you have to be careful that you don't invite a permanency to it. It changes along with all the other aspects of mind and body. So that's true also for feelings, perceptions, impulses, etc. Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear. They are not tainted nor pure, do not increase or decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, impulses, consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no objects of mind, no realm of eyes, and so forth, until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance, and also no extinction of it, no ignorance, and there's no extinction of it, and so forth, until no old age and death, and also no extinction of them, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to obtain, with nothing to attain, the bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. The mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, there's no fears. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three worlds of Buddhas, in the three worlds, all Buddhas depend upon Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the Prajnaparamita is the greatest transcendent mantra, is the greatest bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra. So proclaim the mantra that says, Gate Gate Para Gate Parasam Gate Bodhi Swaha. So let's just look at what all that was about. It's laying out a view, and it's cutting off any path out of that view. It go all the nose and ears and no tongues and bodies and minds and color and sound and smells and taste is to stop any projection of substance outside of the emptiness that is. It's showing you the true emptiness of cessation. Now, I want to talk a little bit about cessation, because in the Theravadin tradition, at least in the style that I practiced very early on, cessation was sort of the hallmark of the beginning of awakening, I might say. I was under the discipleship of Burma, Burmese, and Mahasi Sayadaw, who initiated that. And I left for other parts of Asia, and I was sitting a three-month absolute isolated retreat, and my mind walked through it, the steps to cessation. And I share this with you because I understand when he's saying there is no color, sound, smells, taste, you know, there's no you, there's no me, there's no this and or that. That is cessation. That's the cessation experience. You might say it's complete darkness without a seer of the darkness. You could say it that way, but it's not really darkness. There's something very much that is it that can't be described. And so that is nirvana. I mean, there's absolutely no suffering whatsoever in that state of cessation, but neither is it functional. You can't stay there. You can't get up and even walk around in it. You're just sort of, at least I couldn't. And so therefore, it's completely, everything is completely gone, and yet in some mysterious way, there's a sense of something there that is not of form, and it's not of emptiness. It's neither form nor, anyway, that's as well as I can do. I wrote down when I came out of that, and I kept going into it and out of it. And so I wrote down a few verses that I was going to read, but I don't think I will. I think it's a little too more, anyway. So what is this? You see, what is this leaving us? Where it's a one-way dialogue. It's Avalokiteshvara talking to Sariputra. It's pointing to the heart of reality without mixing words, and it's very firm and straightforward. It's not full of compassionate responses. And this is Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva in compassion, saying, because he wants, the compassion comes in wanting no deviation and not no giving us no outlet from the truth. So the truth, the straight on truth of it is really where this affects me. It's the swinging of Manjushri sword, transcendent wisdom. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. End of story. Well, what about, no. And form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than form. One is the other. The paradox of form and emptiness being complete as it is without dispute. So there are no essential parts to this. It's all equally nothing. Form is a conceptual covering of the mind. And that's what fools us into believing and investing in it. But we're really investing in emptiness. Now, emptiness has never, I've never liked the word because I think it's too barren. I don't think it expresses the ineffable quality of it. And emptiness, I think a better word is incomprehensible. It cannot be understood. And yet it is. It's not nothing, not in the way that we usually ascribe that. It's incomprehensible. It cannot be understood by the mind. So we say to ourselves, well, I don't understand this. I don't understand any of that. Well, I think that's the reason it's recited so often, is that it starts wearing in to your objections to what your life means in relationship to what it says. And instead of standing in the way of the wisdom, it keeps being recited over and over until you sort of have to give over to it. And then it starts sinking in. And I think the repetition of the recitement is really one of its values. Although to sit through it day after day can feel tedious to some. But I do think we have access to it, as I was talking about this morning. I think not access to the sensing of nothing. Because, as I was saying, it's intrinsically what we are. This nothing, this emptiness, this form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And if you don't go to one side or the other, well, that's form, and this is, oh, no, I'm thinking. If you're just quiet with it, which is what it's trying to do by telling you not this, not this, there's no argument. It's ceasing all argument. It's ceasing all the ways that you can find a way out. And so it allows us to sort of be overwhelmed by the truth of it. And if we're quiet, or when we're quiet, and I mean still, not just having a mind that isn't chattering, but a still mind, a mind that isn't moving, there's a deep sensing. And I think many of us who have been practicing for some time have that sense of meeting what we see from our meditation with stillness and knowing. See, as we assume a stillness, the sense of I changes configuration. It's the noise that holds us to being what we are, and our self-definition, of course, but also in terms of our external response to reality and what reality is outside of us. So as we are affected by that stillness, we change shape, we become more permeable. We aren't the solid thing. And neither when we look out is reality the solid thing. They change proportional to each other, not proportional, in direct response to each other. As one changes, the other changes. And so many of us have had that experience at some time or some way during our meditation. We have felt a connection, connectedness, or maybe unity, or maybe full-heartedness. But you see, what's happening during that time, we write it off as the product of the meditation, or if we're on a different setting, maybe the drug I took. But it's never that. This is the way that reality is being perceived in that moment. It's not the effect of a drug, and it's not the effect of the meditation, except meditation encourages the quiet and the stillness that allows that transformation to occur. The transformation occurs when we're not noisy. And that doesn't happen to be happen only in your when you're in meditation. So these transformative ways of seeing the world collectively are as real as the way we see the world now. We just don't bestow the same credibility on it. And it's a very important to know that we have been changing all along the way, but then we pull ourselves back when we come out of the meditation and we think, oh, okay, now I'm back to normal. Back to normal? I would think that Avalokiteshvara has something to argue about that or something to say about that. And I want us to start realizing that these transformations that occur to us and to reality as we quiet are the truth of what reality is. Reality is sustained because of the noise and the governance we put on it. It's not like this, because when I'm quiet, it's not like this. Or when I'm still, the differentiation, once we become still enough, the differentiation between one object and another melts. And the space between them isn't a divider. It's a continuation of the same thing seen. So this is not beyond our comprehension. It's not about something that is so, you know, only for the very, very advanced meditators, you know, or whatever. It's not that. But we have to give it credibility in order for it to move us forward. If we keep coming back to what we call normal, which is seen in a particular and isolated and objective way that we see everything, we hold ourselves in place and we can't move forward. We don't allow the truth of what the meditation stillness is doing to us to become a living truth and begin to see collectively, to be able to see in more of a oneness of things. Although many of us have had that experience and deeply in our heart, we feel the message of that. We're not as apt to respond as vehemently to individuals that are seen as part of the collective, a part of me, a part of everything. And so this transformation into form is emptiness, because that's the way stillness takes us towards emptiness, doesn't mean it loses its color and becomes bland. That's not what emptiness is. It's seeing objects, not as objects, but as appearances, really, appearances. And then very quietly, when cessation occurs, those appearances go away as well. In cessation, there is no subject. And so then there would be, as the way I'm explaining, no object seen, because those two are representative of each other. And then there's all the partial changes that occur as we become quieter and move into that stillness from a different depth of our meditation. So let's not dismiss this and say, oh, I just don't understand what he's talking about. I just don't, you know. No, you do. You do. You do. Or you could. If you just don't dismiss. You see, we're too, that's what the whole problem is. You dismiss this as being worthless and accept this, and pitting one thing against the other keeps us within the world we know. Because all of this is due to the division of this object is only it and not that other object that sits next to it. And so if I keep that separate from that, then I start fracturing all reality into the thingness that we see. See, the Heart Sutra doesn't allow that. It's so absolute. Bow! Don't go that way. And it sets the tone for us to hear it and integrate it into our movement forward. No, you know, there's the list of no's is very important, although often So, okay, just move on. Come on, know this, know that. No, it's very important to hear them all. So the Bodhisattva, when he says no eyes, no ears, no, he's talking about the cessation moment, which is Nirvana. But the Heart Sutra is going beyond that. It doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop with, because there's no functionality in it. The Bodhisattva has gone beyond that, and beyond that as well. Gate, gate, para, gate, parasam, gate, Bodhisattva. Beyond the beyond, beyond, beyond that. True, because true empty is not parts forming a whole. It is all of the same, incomprehensible. All of it. And where do we end up? Right here. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And it's not pitting one against the other. It is the same. Form and emptiness is the same. All the no's of the sutra are to prevent ownership, prevent a direction away. You see, spirituality is really the path without direction. It's here, period. So when I read that sutra, I start to incorporate some of the the absolute Manjushri sword, because that's what it really is. It's coming from that sword of invincibility in its truth. But this view does establish guidance. We are not seeking or looking outside of ourselves. It is here and now or nowhere. The mind stops with that because it has nowhere to go. If it's not anywhere outside of it, it has only now to deal with. And now is not a thing. Now is an everything. And so the mind stops. Thank God. This is a beautiful sutta. Sutra, I don't know. We sense where we are going. We sense it. But how do we move in that direction? You see, it's not a movement. It's a quieting. So to ask yourself, well, how do I get there? You don't get there by going somewhere else. You get there by quieting down from the noise that's already there. Because the noise is what is being, is creating the formations of what it is that this sutra is denying. So I didn't do service to it. I could have spent the whole day on it, but an attempt to putting it into practice and realizing what the Heart Sutra is saying, that's what I wanted to impart. And not to dismiss it as, I don't understand that. I don't get that. Don't do that. Don't do that to anything that has truth in it and you can feel the truth in it. You can feel the truth in the Heart Sutra. Don't dismiss anything that holds even a kernel of truth. Don't do it. Because you dismiss one aspect of truth, all of it goes. All of it changes. You don't know. That's fair enough. I'm interested, I don't know, I'm pulled towards it, I'm curious about it. Those are all fine statements. I don't understand it, that's a fine statement. But to dismiss it as being beyond you, you'll never return. Not in the same way. So we don't want to do that. Now, when I was first starting in my 20s, the first book that had an impact on me, and it really had an impact on me, it just took me right into it, was Be Here Now, Ram Dass's book, 1970 or whatever. And I liked the main part of it because that's what drew me in. And it was like a cold splash of water. It was so, just changed me. I mean, from that day on, I was not the same person. But I wanted to know how to get there. And there's a cookbook section in Be Here Now, and I just ate it up. I had no idea what I was doing. It made no sense at all to me, but I was staring at candle flames and blowing out of one nostril and the other nostril and doing yoga postures and everything that was in that cookbook section, I tried to imitate. And then it just all fell flat because no, it didn't hold any truth for me. It didn't, it wasn't in line with a true direction for what I yearned to see. And so then I got involved in meditation and I could understand watching the mind made sense to me. Watching the mind, you know, that had an impact because I could see what I was seeing, and I wasn't just seeing the mind, I was seeing thoughts that were floating through this space created through the meditation. Now, how can a thought float through? I'm the one that's thinking it. If I'm the one that's thinking it, it can't float through. It has to be mine and felt like a mental state of mind. So that was the first hint of how to use mindfulness. And I want to be careful and guide us through this, because if we want an access point to the Heart Sutra, then this is the way I found my access. There are other ways to do it, but this is the way I found. I first needed to understand what awareness was. And what was going on was there was an object of awareness. That was my breath or body or wherever I was focused. And then there was awareness of that form. And I began to say, oh, well, okay, that's awareness of that form. Although the awareness still felt like mine. I was directing my attention to whatever the form was, to my breath. And so there was those two things, plus an ownership quality that I just supposed was true. But then, as the practice grew and deepened in quietude, I began to hear that person who took ownership of the awareness. I could hear that person in subtle commentary talking to owning the awareness and talking about what it was seeing. Now, I had at this point been able to hear the thoughts of the mind and the disposition of the mind and the emotions of the mind, and I knew those were not, that I was somehow not generating those. They were coming out on their own. It wasn't, there was no longer an ownership in a thought some of the time while I was sitting. So as I quieted down, I was interested in the commentary, the narrative, about what it was saying, it was seeing. And I could begin to hear it. Now, I could also hear the distortions that once this awareness was personalized, I am being aware. Once the I was in place, the commentary was in place, and the awareness that was seeing through that commentary was being distorted by that commentary. It was being distorted back into form. The commentary was a very subtle thinking, but it was being, the awareness was being seen through the commentary. So then I thought, okay, this is, you don't have to follow this particular line, but you have to follow your own line of curiosity. So what I thought, okay, now what if I'm quiet to the commentary? What if there is quiet? Not me, because I would just be establishing myself at the other end of the commentary, watching the commentary as more commentary. So I knew that wasn't going to work. But if I was just quiet with the, if there was quiet, see, I have to keep myself out of this, because now we're out of myself. If there is stillness that holds the commentary. Now listen closely, because this was a really revelation for me. There's no one directing the awareness. It was seeing without someone seeing it. There was no one seeing. The awareness was just occurring. And it was occurring 360 degrees around the commentary. And that shook me because I realized that I wasn't necessary. In fact, as I began to elaborate more upon that reaction and to hold the truth of it and follow the truth in, the self started to become more of a fabrication than a truth itself. So we have to, my way was to begin to separate the seeing from the thing we see. We are not the owners of awareness. Awareness has no owners. And this, I mean, this takes us, this is weird. As I say it, I think, are any of you going to believe this? Awareness has no owner. It just sees. That's all it does. We are not seeing. Now listen to this. We are not seeing. We are being seen. And we can free the awareness up so that it is seeing us. It's not, now we've switched the whole, now we've turned over the, we've made it, we've turned over the can of worms or whatever that expression is. So right now, as, because I'd like to bring you in to the implication of this, right now, what, not who, what is seeing out of your eyes? Just look, just. Just let the seeing stand on its own. You don't have, you're not needed. In fact, you can be seen by the awareness. If you're quiet enough and allow yourself to be seen, you can be seen by the awareness. We are not the ones that have been seen at any time in our life, ever. The seeing has been seen, and we've been claiming ownership of it. There's the object, and then there is the seeing. But remember, the seeing is formless, and the object is form. And form is formless, and formlessness is form. So those two are really one and the same thing. The object and the seeing are not differentiated. And as those two come together, the whole world begins to be formless awareness, the unconscious, or the unconditioned, excuse me. Not unconscious, the unconditioned. Now we have cleaned up the mindfulness sufficiently. And you know it's true, because you've seen, it's been seen. And once it's seen, you know it's true. I mean, there's no argument, no argument. That's what Avalokiteshvara says. There's no argument to this. This was seen. I love that, because that's what truth does. It's like not, it's not equivocated. Do you see that? So we have to learn. Mindfulness is a great starting point. And for some people, it goes right on through their life, which is fine, because it gives you a lot. It's not devoid of truth. It's mindfulness. It's, we can see the mind. We begin to take ourselves differently once the mind is seen with thoughts arising independent of me and my emotions. And you can see the self-influence that we offer those emotions and how they come about and how we describe ourselves within them. All of that, which is tremendously helpful and self-caring. But there's still a limitation. The limitation is that we're still seeing through the mind, through the commentary. And that distorts mindfulness. And so to be aware of how to use mindfulness so that we can move beyond formation into the formless. And again, Ajahn Buddhadasa used to talk about conventional and hidden teachings. And conventional way of using mindfulness is the way we learned it. But there's a hidden teaching under that. And the teaching, it's not that far, it's not that much an extension to say, I can hear my thoughts even while I'm thinking my thoughts in commentary about what I'm seeing, to start including that commentary as part of the thoughts I'm seeing. Does that make sense? And so, if you're interested, if it's the right timing for you, if you feel steady in being able to go in a different direction, then, and you're curious. Curiosity is, to me, the marker of readiness to enter hidden teachings. Oh, what is that? God, that's interesting. What is this? Like that. And then you'll naturally go there in spirit and in inquiry. And you'll start digging into that until those become realized truths. Realization is what we want. Realization you can't turn back from realization. You can from from ideology, you can from intellectual naming, and the one thing you can't turn back with, because it's etched into you, is realized wisdom. And realized wisdom comes about through actually experiencing, not thinking about, but experiencing the teaching straight on. So that's the second talk. Are your heads spinning or are they still on your shoulders? Okay, so I don't want to leave you with nothing. I want to leave you with a way forward, with something that's, I can do this. Listen, if I can do this, you can do this. If Avalokiteshvara can do it, I'm not sure I can do it. But if I can do it, you can do it. It's just whether you have the drive. And I don't mean effort or will, just the interest to see your way out of this mess called humanity and to escape the I conclusion, the I am conclusion. The I am conclusion distorts everything it moves through. Now, okay, I talk about this later, I think, at some point, but I'm going to say it now. The sense of I am, we usually think of as being separate from the mind. And the I am has a mind. No, no. The mind holds you as a thought, I am. And you cannot differentiate the two. You cannot separate those out. And once you bring them together, the whole thing begins. It's another access point, like seeing from the behind the commentary. When you see yourself as mind and stop differentiating those two, it becomes a very, very different world. Okay, so I'm going to give you access points throughout these 2 days together. Whether you take them up, that's up to you and what you want to do. And some of you look very miserable and critical and skeptical, and some of you are smiling and some of you aren't. So I can't deal with that. You have to deal with that. I'm just telling you the truth. That's all I'm doing here. You may not like it. I don't like what Avalokiteshvara It takes me away from my girlfriends or whatever. Well, it's true.